Oregon Justice Resource Center. Welcome, Zach.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Zach, Oregon Justice Resource Center, or OJRC, introduced three bills in the 2021 Oregon legislative session that were unsuccessful. So OJRC is now reintroducing those same bills in the 2022 session. So can you briefly just mention those three bills, and then we'll go back and talk in detail about each one?
So we have three bills, as you mentioned. The first is the Oregon Justice for Exonerees Act, which is Senate Bill 1584. Last session, it was SB 499, so Senate Bill 499. And just a quick overview is it provides exonerees access to the court to address harm caused by the state and to be compensated for that harm for their years wrongfully incarcerated and on supervision. The second bill is Restoration of Voting Rights Act. It's HB, House Bill 4147. This was last session, it was on the House and the Senate side as HB 2366 and SB 571. And this is being introduced by Rep. Reynolds this session. And it would allow people who are currently incarcerated in Oregon prisons to vote while they are incarcerated. And then finally, the third one is Compassionate Medical Release, which is SB 1568. It's being introduced by Senator Dembro and Rep. Reynolds in the Senate this session. And it's formerly HB 3298. And SB 835 last session. And so that's being introduced to fix the compassionate release process and system that we currently have in place, which is the pandemic has highlighted some significant concerns with that process.
So let's start with the compassionate release bill, Senate Bill 1568. That is releasing adults in custody under extraordinary circumstances. Give a little background about this bill.
What I would say is that the pandemic has kind of highlighted some areas that need to be improved, a lot of areas that need to be improved in the criminal justice system. Now, that's not to say that this was working before the pandemic, but it was definitely highlighted because no one was being released under it, right? So instead of the Board of Parole being able to release under their compassionate medical release process that currently exists, Governor Brown ended up having to do grant a lot of clemencies. Using her clemency power. And so that was concerning to us because that's not necessarily the way it's supposed to work. There should be a robust system for the Board of Parole to weigh in on these situations and allow individuals who qualify for compassionate release to be released under it. So the information we've received is that only two people in about the past 8-9 years have actually been released under it. And it's because when individuals apply for it, they generally are superseded by those who are currently seeking parole or release from the Board of Parole. And so they are knocked down and the Board of Parole is just overworked. And so they don't get to these cases and these applicants.
There has to be extraordinary compelling reasons to release a person in custody. So talk about some of these reasons that this bill would require before someone is released from prison.
Absolutely. So this generally what we're trying to get at are individuals who are, you know, medically infirm or vulnerable. And so I believe the one criteria is individuals who are terminally ill. And I believe we've set that at 12 months. And so they would be able to be released under this. And what we've done is we've set the bill up so that it's implemented kind of in phases. And so between hopefully the implementation in 23 after the 22 session, in 2025, there's a very small amount of individuals who will be eligible for release, and there's a cap of 5 people per month that can be released under the bill. And that's to allow for ramping up of administrative positions and also to allow this independent committee that we've established under the bill to get up and running. And so individuals who have serious medical concerns would be able to be eligible under the bill. And then that criteria should expand once we get to year 2025.
And talk about this medical release advisory committee that you just mentioned. Now, that is something that is new, that people are not being reviewed by medical personnel. Is that correct?
Currently, the Board of Parole, who I don't believe have any medical professionals amongst them, they would be taking in these applications and making this analysis. And a lot of times what we find is, whether it's because of the current system, how it's set up, or whether it's because they're not medical professionals, the analysis generally starts with a public safety analysis and then shifts to the compassionate release or the medical issues. And we believe at OJRC that it should actually be the other way around. When you're talking about compassionate medical release, you should be talking about the medical conditions first and whether someone qualifies and then the public safety second. And so that's the way this is set up, to allow an independent committee made up of 5 to 13 medical professionals, licensed medical professionals, who can review these applications and say whether someone meets the criteria. They will then give a recommendation to either the board or the sentencing court. Those are the two routes that you can go for various kind of technical legal reasons. Certain people will be eligible through the sentencing courts, and certain people will be eligible through the Board of Parole to be released. So the independent committee will then make a recommendation, and that recommendation is a presumption. So there's a presumption attached. And so what ends up happening is that the Board of Parole or the sentencing court will have to show by clear and convincing evidence that someone is a threat to public safety to kind of overcome that presumption of release from the independent committee.
And you mentioned 5 cases per month. Now, this advisory committee will review 5 cases, up to 5 cases per month. That doesn't mean that there will be 5 individuals released from prison under this a compassionate release bill.
That's correct. They will review 5 completed applications. And so there's kind of a process to go through. And so the idea is that they can review 5 completed applications. Correct. That doesn't necessarily mean that 5 individuals will be released every month.
Now, recently, a lawsuit was filed by the Oregon District Attorneys and relatives of 3 homicide victims accusing Governor Brown of illegally freeing nearly 1,000 inmates during the pandemic. How does this affect the outcome of this legislation?
We see them as 2 separate issues. I think the concern with the governor using clemency for medical releases, I think, is separate from the clemency that the district attorney's just filed a lawsuit about. That's about individuals who weren't able to avail themselves of SB 1008 from, I believe, the 2019 session that was passed that helps alleviate some of the strict sentencing of youth, individuals who are convicted as youth and tried as adults. And so, you know, our position is that we support the governor's use of clemency in that situation, but we don't see that necessarily impacting the use here. I think if the district attorneys have concerns about the governor's clemency power, I think this is a perfect bill to support for at least the medical aspect of things, because it does place this back into the courts and to the Board of Parole, hopefully allowing the governor not to have to use clemency on these kind of medical or mass medical releases like we saw during the pandemic and the wildfires.
So, Zach, the second bill is SB 1584, the Oregon Justice for Exonerees Act. Talk about this act, and also talk about these bills and why you feel that they will be successful in this new 2022 session.
So this bill is an amazing bill. It feels common sense to us, but last session, I will say that there were some issues with the fiscal analysis and how much it was going to cost the state. And I think that kind of got us caught up last session. And so this session, or in the interim between last session and this session, we've worked very closely with kind of a coalition. We call it the Oregon Innocence Coalition, which is the Oregon Innocence Project, which is under the Oregon Justice Resource Center, the National Innocence Project, and then also Forensic Justice Project, which is another Portland-based nonprofit. And so we have worked together with the Department of Justice on the fiscal impact that this bill is going to have. And we've had numerous meetings with them, and, you know, happy to report that we've figured out the fiscal, and we are working with the Ways and Means Committee, which is a budgeting committee. And also the Department of Justice has now come out publicly in support of the bill and believes that this should be accomplished this session. So we feel really, really good about the bill moving forward. The bill is going to be introduced by Senator Thatcher again, who's a Republican senator in Oregon, and she's going to be reintroducing the bill this session. That said, the bill has significant bipartisan support. And mainly, I think that's to do with just the Oregon value of compensating individuals who were exonerated and spent years upon years in prison for something that they didn't do. And so this bill provides exonerees access to the court to address harms caused by the state, being the wrongful conviction. It would provide $65,000 per year of wrongful imprisonment. It would provide $25,000 for every year spent on parole, post-prison supervision, or sex offender registry. On top of the monetary compensation, it would also provide access to non-monetary services, which would include counseling, housing assistance, personal financial literacy assistance, those kind of non-monetary support systems that need to be included in this bill. And then it would ensure a straightforward process for filing compensation claims through the court. So currently, individuals would have to file a lawsuit, a civil rights lawsuit generally, in the courts. And so it's a long drawn out process. And the hope is that this will streamline that process for exonerees. And then lastly, addressing kind of the concerns for re-entering society back, even as an exoneree, the bill would expunge the records associated with the wrongful conviction and arrest and provide a certificate of innocence. That way the exonerees hopefully can stand a better chance of clearing the record and bringing their name back to being able to get jobs and moving forward in their life.
So will this bill be retroactive? When would this go into effect?
Sure. Retroactivity is an interesting word. I think, so technically, yes, it would apply to individuals who were wrongfully convicted in the past. That said, they only have, I believe it's a two or three year window to file their claims under this bill. And so we anticipate, you know, anywhere between 11 and 15 individuals who we believe we've identified as being potentially eligible under this, who were wrongfully incarcerated and then exonerated. So there's going to be kind of an initial amount of claims, maybe around 11 to 15. And then after that, we expect in Oregon, we have about one exoneration every 18 months, roughly, is kind of, I think, how it breaks down. And so that would then proceed that way.
So we're not talking about a lot of adults in custody filing this claim. And according to the National Registry of Exonerations, there's only been 22 exonerations in Oregon.
That's correct. And not all of them have been incarcerated. So the number's even lower for those who've actually been incarcerated. And then there's other factors that would need to be satisfied to collect under this bill.
Zach, how are people found to be wrongfully convicted? Is it through DNA? How is that happening?
Yeah, there's various different avenues to exoneration. The interesting thing about Oregon is, and other states actually, it's not unique to Oregon, but there's not necessarily kind of a claim for actual innocence anywhere. So there's various different ways to get there. One, for example, would be Earl Bain, who's an exoneree in Oregon, who was pardoned by the governor on actual innocence grounds, and yet he didn't have redress for the court, right? So the court didn't say that he was actually innocent, but the governor did. And what someone would have to do under this bill is go into court and affirmatively show that they did not commit the crimes for which they were convicted of. And so that will be generally be used similar to the facts that you would present to either the court or to the governor for clemency or a pardon. And so that is the way you would show it. So it can be DNA. It can be sometimes recantation, any type of misconduct by the government that potentially shows that someone is actually innocent. So there's a wide array of eyewitness identifications is a big concern as well. So a bunch of different ways to be wrongfully convicted, unfortunately.
So let's go to the third bill, voter registration, and that is House Bill 4147. And again, did not pass the 2021 legislative session. So talk about this bill.
This is a bill that would actually be the first in the nation. It would re-enfranchise about 12,000 to 13,000 individuals who are currently in prison who are not allowed to vote. And so it's being introduced by Rep. Reynolds this session. I would say that last session, what happened similar to compensation is the bill passed out of Senate Judiciary Committee, which is the policy committee, and then was languished, I would say, in the budgeting committee, the Ways and Means Committee. And that was from a Department of Corrections fiscal that was kind of unanticipated. And I think there were some concerns amongst legislators with kind of what the bill actually does. And so our goal was to clarify what it does and to address the fiscal issue in the interim. And so we've been working really hard to kind of educate the legislature on what the bill does and what it doesn't do, and then also addressing the fiscal with Department of Corrections. And so the bill, mainly what it does is it, as I mentioned, it provides incarcerated individuals access to the political system by restoring their right to vote. And so we're working with Next Up Oregon on this bill, and we really see it as a pro-democracy bill. I think it impacts criminal justice, but it really is about re-enfranchising individuals and allowing them to have a say and a voice.
So can you talk a little bit about the history of why prisoners or adults in custody are not allowed to vote here in Oregon?
Absolutely. So the landscape is that there's only been two states that didn't disenfranchise currently incarcerated individuals, Maine and Vermont, which those of us who are familiar with the East Coast would know that those are two of the whitest states in the country. And so that's telling, because the history behind disenfranchisement generally, including those who are currently incarcerated, and this applies to even people convicted of felonies being disenfranchised, which in Oregon is no longer the case, but in other states it is still the case. And it's born out of the Jim Crow era. It is based on Black exclusion laws and the understanding that if the system disproportionately incarcerates people of color, and then you disenfranchise those same people who are being incarcerated, you are therefore being able to suppress the voices essentially of the communities of color. And so that's really what this is born out of. And I think what ends up happening is people conflate this with just the way it's supposed to be or the way it's always been, and that's not necessarily the case. So for example, in Oregon, we don't need a constitutional amendment because Oregon's constitution prohibits people in prison from voting unless otherwise provided by law. And so here it's just a statutory change which requires a simple majority vote. In contrast to Illinois, which is running a similar bill in February as well in their session over there, you know, there's an argument there about whether there needs to be a constitutional amendment. The proponents are saying there doesn't, but that's not the case in Oregon. It really is a statutory fix because it's not always been the case in Oregon that individuals who are incarcerated can't vote.
And we should say that Oregonians can vote when they're released from prison and on post-prison supervision. They do have the right to vote, or they regain the right to vote currently. So how important is it to hear the voices of adults in custody through their vote?
Just also want to add that people who are currently incarcerated in jails can vote if they are incarcerated on misdemeanor charges or convictions, or if they're pretrial, even on felony charges. So there's already voting going on in the correctional facilities, usually county jails. And I think the importance of voting, really, the best people to speak to that are people who are currently incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. I myself am formerly incarcerated, and so I have a unique kind of insight into why it's important. I think that there's a misunderstanding out there that people who are incarcerated aren't civically engaged or don't want to be engaged in the community. And that's just not the case. Those who are incarcerated still have family on the outside in the communities. So it's really important, especially with school board elections, the way we've seen them in Oregon and across the country. You know, individuals who are incarcerated with kids want to have a say in who's leading the school districts for which their kids are attending. And they want to have a say in how the community that their spouse or family is living in. And so that's why this bill, which allows them to register at their last voluntary address, is really important, because they're not voting where the prison is located. They're voting in the communities that they're from and that they're going to be returning to, since 95% of individuals who are in prison are going to be returning to the community. And then those who are currently incarcerated, who even if they're not going to get released, there are unique situations that people who are incarcerated face. For example, I believe the Oregonian found that it's something like individuals who are incarcerated are 10 times more likely to contract COVID than those in the general population. And there's also the wildfires was another example of situations that impact mainly just those who are incarcerated. So the wildfires impacted a lot of Oregonians, but the ones who were incarcerated can't just evacuate. They can't just move. They're at the mercy of DOC. And so those issues aren't necessarily understood by the legislators as much or as well, because those who are incarcerated aren't constituents. And so there's less of an incentive to listen to them. So that's why it's really important that they be allowed to vote. There's issues that impact them just like everyone else in Oregon.
And Zach, there's some prison gerrymandering occurring here in Oregon.
So prison gerrymandering is generally considered a separate issue. At the same time, it very much interacts with this bill. And so prison gerrymandering is the counting of AICs, or adults in custody, for census purposes, where they're residing in the correctional facility. And so this results in generally increased funding, because the amount of residents in those counties or areas in which the prisons are located, those AICs, which can, you know, number in the thousands, are counted as residents of that area. And so prison gerrymandering is generally seen kind of going along with this, which is why it's important that when individuals vote, their voice be heard in the communities that they're going to A, be released to, and also B, come from. And then that's also an argument for why individuals should be counted for census purposes and for, you know, allocation of funding purposes, in the places that they're going to be released to, or where they, you know, the counties that they've come from. So they're intertwined. I think it's on the agenda at some point to address prison gerrymandering. We think that this is it's really important that the voices be heard, and then we can also address kind of the allocation of funding issue under prison gerrymandering.
You know, on voter registration for adults in custody, the bottom line for me is 95% of adults in custody are returning to their communities. And how do we want them to come home civically minded, engaged? It just makes sense.
Absolutely. And I would encourage anyone to, I know OLIS, the Oregon legislative website, is sometimes hard to navigate, but I would encourage anyone who can to listen to the hearing that we had on HB 2366 last session in rules. And we had two individuals, we were able to record their testimony, two currently incarcerated individuals who spoke. And I think when you compare that to individuals in the general public who maybe don't see voting as being important, or, you know, maybe don't trust the voting process or the elections process and don't value it, when you contrast that with the adults in custody who spoke at that hearing, it's really pretty evident how important this is to those who are incarcerated to be able to vote. And so, right, they're going to be returning to our communities. It's part of what we think is necessary, which is kind of a holistic approach to helping individuals when they return, and they need to be civically engaged and need to be connected to their communities so that when they return, they can hit the ground running and be able to reenter successfully.
One of my favorite quotes from one of those adults in custody was, "Prison is about the loss of liberty, not the loss of citizenship."
Absolutely. And that's a perfect example. You know, one of the arguments we hear a lot of times against the bill is that these individuals committed a crime and therefore they should lose their rights. Well, that's a pretty bold statement. I think that anyone who has been incarcerated understands the real significant punishment is the loss of liberty. You can't go where you want, when you want. You're residing in a place that you don't have any choice or say in. And so that's really the punishment. And there's no nexus between the punishment of losing the right to vote and any of the crimes that these individuals are serving time on. And so I think that's hugely important to remember. We shouldn't just strip away rights just because it's something that we've done for years, or because we want to punish individuals. That's the loss of liberty.
How involved in other areas or other legislation is Oregon Justice Resource Center in the 2022 Oregon legislative session?
So, and just for the listeners, the 2022 session is a short session. In Oregon, we alternate long session, short session. And the short session is, I believe, 35 days. It's February 1st to, I think, March 6th or something. And so it's really condensed. And so the three bills are really taking up a lot of our time. I will say that we're tracking or just keeping an eye on two other bills. There's a bill, I believe it's the Lewis and Clark Criminal Justice Clinic, which is working with Senator Pozanski on a non-unanimous jury verdict bill, which would provide a cause of action for individuals, post-conviction review cause of action, essentially, to allow individuals who were convicted by a non-unanimous jury verdict to petition the court to have their convictions overturned and potentially sent back to the district attorney's office. And so that's a bill, we're still evaluating the language of it. We've just seen draft language. And so, but we're tracking it. And then the other thing we're tracking is HB 2002, 2002, which I believe the session is now SB 1510, I believe is coming back. We haven't seen any language on it, but we are going to be tracking it once it's introduced and we see the language.
So Zach, tell people how they can find these bills, Oregon Justice Resource Center's website.
For OJRC, listeners can follow us or stay updated and find more information about us and various projects at ojrc.info on Instagram and Twitter at OJRC Center. So OJRC and then ENTER, and Facebook for more information on the bills that we're running. And then in terms of finding out kind of generally what's going on or staying up to date, there's the Oregon legislative website. You can always look up bills that are introduced in the session and find out when the next hearing is, or submit testimony through that process. I think the easiest for listeners is probably to email your legislators, letting them know that you support a bill, that you want them to act on a bill, or to vote yes on it.
Can you talk a little bit about legislation that was passed in 2021 that OJRC was involved with that will now go into effect in 2022?
Absolutely. So we had a few bills that passed that we were directly involved in, and then about three bills that I've identified that we were very supportive of and did some work on at various times throughout the session. And so one of them was HB 3145, which was a Rep. Bynum-related policing bill And so that requires law enforcement to report any discipline resulting in economic sanctions against an officer and to report that information to the DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, for publication on their database. And so it wasn't necessarily everything that we wanted, definitely wasn't everything we wanted. However, we have heard already that defense attorneys have found it helpful to just have another layer of misconduct reported to this database that DPSST keeps. Another bill is SB 836, which requires that DOC cannot suspend or terminate an alternative incarceration program in its entirety for more than 5 consecutive days, unless it considers all alternative actions. And so the reason for this bill is that during the beginning of the pandemic, the Department of Corrections was limiting or even terminating AIPs or alternative incarceration programs, which adults in custody use to receive treatment, to better themselves, to work on themselves, and then sometimes get a benefit of an earlier release date because of that. And so when the Department of Corrections just suspends or terminates AIPs, then the release dates are thrown into flux. And so what you have is people who were relying on a certain release date now having that pushed back. And so that was a big concern for us. I saw that firsthand at the Pathfinder Network, which is where I worked before the Oregon Justice Resource Center. And so I saw it firsthand, the effect that that had. And so this bill is really an attempt to hopefully make sure that doesn't happen again. There was SB 418, which was Senator Gorsuch's bill last session, which prohibits coercion and other forms of deceit by law enforcement when interviewing a youth. And so it creates a rebuttable presumption that the statement made by a youth during an interrogation or, quote, custodial interview, which is sometimes how the police decide to phrase interrogation, and they can't intentionally use false information to elicit statements. And so, but it was a huge win for Oregon and second in the nation to pass this bill. So it was an incredibly important bill. And I think our hope is that we can get this to apply to adults as well at some point in the near future. There's SB 817, which eliminated fees and court costs and fines associated with juvenile delinquency matters. Another huge youth justice related bill, and really makes a huge difference in the youth who have been adjudicated or convicted and are trying to, you know, successfully reenter and don't have these huge fines and fees hanging over them. And then lastly, which is kind of relevant to what's going to be happening coming up in another election, but SJR 10, Senate Resolution 10, which is an anti-slavery constitutional amendment. It asked the people to vote to modernize the Oregon Constitution through an amendment to abolish a provision that allows involuntary servitude and slavery. So it's generally a surprise to, I think, a lot of Oregonians when they find out that our Constitution still allows for actual slavery for those who are incarcerated. And so that's an important resolution that'll be, I believe, on the ballot coming up.
And again, for our listeners, this 2022 legislative session is about 35 days. So if you're going to act, contact your legislator immediately and let them know how important these bills are. And Zach, all the best to OJRC doing some fabulous work, and all the best luck with these bills during this session. I know you're hopeful. It is looking promising.
Absolutely. I think the various bills have different outlooks and different unique circumstances, but we are very hopeful to pass all 3 of these bills. They would be a huge benefit to Oregon.
My guest has been Zach Winston, Policy Director with Oregon Justice Resource Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers, and thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.